Well, let's take our seats. I think everybody's here, and we introduced ourselves yesterday. We have two new arrivals today. Rosemarie Maher of Northway, and you're president of the Village Corporation there, and we welcome you. And Daniel Fessler, who is advisor to the state's Statutory Law Revision Committee and is working on and developing the new corporate code from the state. And I don't have my notes in front of me, but Mr. Fessler, you're from California, the University of?
University of California at Davis.
At Davis, right. Well, we welcome you too, sir. And I think that we can begin. Yesterday, we had some general discussion about 1991 and its implications, and John Taylor and Paul Goodwin and others talked about what would happen if there were no changes in the legislation. We also discussed towards the end of the day some of the remedies that might be adopted to ensure that Native corporations and Native land remained under Native control. A number of suggestions were mooted. It was suggested by Elizabeth Johnston, for instance, that the only way to ensure that Native corporations remained in Native hands was to restrict the transfer of shares. Glenn Fredericks, speaking for the Kuskokwim Corporation with 1,200 shareholders in the bush, said that their principal concern is to ensure that the land remains in Native hands, and Glenn Fredericks said that he thought the key thing was to separate the land from the corporation so that if the corporation got into hot water, the land would be safe, and we discussed that. I took the liberty of suggesting at the end of the day that all that I had found at the meetings I've been holding in the villages was that people were regarded land and the safekeeping of Native land for future generations as the paramount consideration. And I suggested that the schemes being considered to address 1991 had to meet three criteria. That is, they had to protect the land against corporate failure, against corporate takeovers, and against taxation of subsistence or undeveloped land by the state. So we're ready to look at the AFN resolutions today, and we thought this afternoon we would ask the village people to talk about 1991 from their point of view. But I asked Charlie Johnson if he would lead the discussion this morning, lead off. And after Charlie, we'll ask Monroe Price and Elizabeth Johnson, if we may, to comment on the AFN resolutions, because both of them have had something to do with putting them together, as I understand it. So Charlie, why don't you start off?
Okay, thank you. Let me give a little background on, as to how these resolutions were developed. We started out about 3 years ago. In 1981, we had some discussions amongst us, amongst the board members and people at AFN and corporations on, it was kind of informal between different people of what are we going to do about 1991. And that ended up in a retreat in Kotzebue that summer in 1970 or 1981. The point of the discussion at that time, we went through about 2 days of discussing some of the points that Bart discussed when he opened up the meeting here yesterday. is what are we and what do we want to be? We talked a lot about the conflicts that are kind of inherent in us because of the way the Land Claims Act is written up. A lot of discussion about are we really being native by accepting the corporate mode? Is there some other form that's more suitable to natives? How are we going to remain natives? How are we going to protect the land? And that was our first meeting. It lasted for 2 days, and it was a very good opening discussion, I felt, and I think those that participated felt that way. And that led to a series of more discussions and retreats, and we've held now approximately eight or nine retreats. A couple of them here in Anchorage, but usually we try to go to places like Cordova or Kodiak or Kotzebue and go over points of how we wanted and how we felt and where we felt our future should be, what we were going to do with the Land Claims Act, does it need changing? We went through all these questions. One of the things that we did was last year at the AFN convention, we introduced some general principles that were adopted by the convention about how we should address 1991 and the changes. The resolutions that we have and we presented at this year's convention, we presented not specifically as you see them. And if, for those of you that have this paper in front of you, it lists those resolutions. We, at these retreats, we kind of drafted them in principle or stated them, and then we gave them to the attorneys, and then they compressed them into these resolutions that were more technical, I guess, and more specific. At this year's convention, what we did was we did not adopt these resolutions. What we did was adopt a process that was supported by the delegates to the convention that before we adopted specific resolutions to ask for specific legislation, that at first we needed to go out to the villages and the regions and get responses from our people on how they felt about these specific ideas. And after that, we would hold another convention, a special convention in March of next spring, and formally adopt them as AFN, and then take them to Congress with the specific legislation that we were going to be asking for. We've discussed this, by the way, with our congressional delegation, and at the convention got a very strong commitment from Senator Stevens that he would do everything possible in his power to ensure that the resolutions that was passed at our next convention, that he would introduce them and do everything he could to see that they passed. So the process that we're going through now is we're going to take these out to the regions. Each of the regions are going to go out to the villages and get some response on the specific resolutions, and then we're going to come back in March. Okay, additionally, what we're also trying to do is to involve more directly the villages in the convention and the decisions at AFN. So what we've also done is we've appointed a committee made up of members of both the profit and nonprofit side to start working on how to involve the villages more. Additionally, what we're doing, and we've asked each of the regions along with AFN, both profits and nonprofits, to sponsor a meeting of its village corporations to select not only the village corporations but the IRA councils and traditional councils as well, to select some people to come to a January meeting. And that January meeting here in Anchorage would be of primarily village people, for them to select somebody to work with the AFN appointed committee to draw plans on how to include more directly the villages, both IRAs and
corporations in the process that AFN is going through. And we felt that the 1991 issue is the ideal situation for us to coalesce that participation that we need from the villages if we're in fact going to be effective in representing the entire Native population. So that's basically the process that we've set out to do at AFN with addressing these specific resolutions that you see. In the retreats, we centered on the issues that I'm sure most of you have heard of. That is basically, how do we protect our land? How do we keep the corporations and the land under Native control? How do we benefit the elders? How do we include those born after 1971? Those specific or those general areas are where we concentrated. We had some lively discussions on some of these issues. We had some differences, obviously, because of the differences of the makeup of the different regions, and the wording on the resolution, which really provides options rather than specific courses, or rather than dictating specific actions. It really just provides options for each region to take, was really what finally unified us as the 12 or 13, you know, diverse regions. At first, we were talking in our early meetings of, in fact, we would put in restrictions on land. We would put in restrictions on non-natives and things like that. And we ran into a lot of problems getting together on these issues. When we finally decided and were kind of pushed into really making them options rather than specific restrictions that were automatic, then at last we got unified on supporting the resolutions that we will present to the villages. So each of the resolutions that we have put together are options rather than specific directed courses of actions. So with that, I can, unless Glenn wants to add something, or Marlene, because they participated heavily, and so did Liz, in these some of these discussions, we can go to the specific resolutions.
Glenn, Marlene, anything to add?
Only thing I would add is that we did stress options, and I think what Charlie's saying is very true. And I know myself from the village, I wanted that option. And Charlie says we had some heated arguments, but I think that's the way to go.
Okay, if you want to go over the specific resolutions, in this...
Just before you do that, Charlie, could I ask a question? You mentioned the 13th region. Were they part of this, if I may ask?
Okay, we invited the 13th to each of the retreats. They did participate in one or two. I can't remember which specific ones, but they did participate. And the resolutions address not only the 12 regions in Alaska, but also the 13th, because they are an ANCSA corporation. And it provides them, although they don't all, everything doesn't apply to them, obviously, because they don't have land to. We've asked for like ANILCA protections of land. Of course, those things would not apply to the 13th. However, I think such things as stock alienation and other things would apply, and so we did ask their participation.
Yeah. Well, why don't you start off with the first one, and then we can perhaps discuss them one by one.
Okay, in this printout that you see here, if you open to the very center of the thing and open it up, it just has headlines. It says 1991 resolutions. And this is a printout that was put out by Tundra Times. The first resolution specifically sets out, I think, a process that affects all of them, and that is that changes or options, rather than being accepted by a board, will be accepted by the stockholders. And I can read you the resolved. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the FNN Convention Assembly endorses the concept that whenever a corporation is given an option with regard to a concept, that option shall be exercised by a vote of the shareholders. Be it resolved that the board of directors of each corporation shall establish a minimum shareholder vote to exercise the option, but the minimum vote shall not be less than the majority of a quorum of shareholders. No dissenters' rights to stock purchase, repurchase by the corporation shall be available if a corporation exercises an option. And maybe I should let Monroe or somebody who is an attorney discuss what the real effect of this is. But one of the things that we discussed at these retreats was that anything that needs to be done has to be done by the stockholders rather than by the board, and I think that's really the intent of the first one.
Well, I'll just say that, as I recall, there was some disagreement about what level of shareholder support there should be for the approval of removing restrictions or other aspects of the as it might ultimately turn out. And the question was, should the resolutions set a mandatory shareholder vote percentage for all corporations? Should it be different for different options? Who should decide? Congress, the corporation, the board, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the result.
David Case?
Maybe one of you can refresh my recollection. What is the, what's the likely quorum to be for any particular corporation? Are we talking about 50% of all shareholders, 1/3, 10%? What's the range of possibility?
Well, I think most of the quorums of the corporations is 1/2 plus 1. But you know, that was not specifically discussed or argued at any point. There was, however, some discussion, as Monroe stated, at what level of, what number or percentage of stockholders should vote on some of these specific things. Now, as you know, in corporations, it's often very difficult to get stockholders to vote. In my corporation, we have a quorum of 1/2 plus 1. Lately, we have not had any problems getting a quorum. Our average turnout has been 52%. This last election we had, we had a 66% turnout, and the reason we had such a large turnout, we were discussing change in the structure of the board to give villages more representation on our board, and so consequently we had a much larger turnout and much more interest generated. But in the past, while the last few years we have not had a problem getting a quorum, it has been 1/2 plus 1. I know before I was on either the board or in the presidency, we've had to delay our meetings as much as 30 days in order to get quorums. So,
what's the minimum quorum permitted, Liz?
Among all native corporations.
The minimum quorum permitted in this state is 1/3, and some of the native corporations do have a quorum requirement that is as low as 1/3, which means, of course, if it's a majority of the quorum, it would be, as was alluded to yesterday, that you could have as low a figure as 17% making this kind of corporate decision, which is somewhat in tension with the general views of good corporate governance. The second thing that's in this, and as Charlie mentioned, it was an effort to solve the fact that among the corporations themselves, there were different views on how this could be handled, and not wishing Congress itself to set this. But by letting the board of directors set it, you have an interesting phenomenon, which is the board itself can decide then out of 2 through 8 which of those resolutions the board itself thinks are hunky-dory and which they think are not so good, and have different requirements for different ones. It's also a resolution that has hidden in it the possibility of a great movement of power from shareholders to the board. And that is in there, and I think it should be seriously considered as a problem.
Well, you've caught our attention, I think. Could you explain a little bit what you meant by that last remark?
Okay. If a board of directors is the one to set the requirements for what the standards of passage are, and as you know, in corporate law, you could, again, you could go as low as a majority of the quorum, which I've indicated in the Cook Inlet situation might be your 17% figure. That would be an affirmative vote, could go as low as that, or it could go as high as some of the supermajority requirements that can be established in corporate law, like 90%. If I, as a board member, am permitted as the body of the board, am permitted the discretion on each of these resolutions to set figures that go all the way from 17% up to 90%, then I myself, as the body of the board, can almost fix the race, okay? If I tell you how high you have to jump before you can pass some of these things, I can, some of us can only jump so high. Charlie, I think, was extremely accurate on the fact that some places have difficulties in getting certain levels of participation. So you do have a problem, a reality problem, that this is trying to deal with. But I'm just warning you of the abuse problem that's here too, which is the potential of abuse of a board of directors setting different standards for passage based on whether they want it to pass or not. And that, I think, is a problem.
I'd like to just ask you one question.
Monroe Price.
Without
I'm only stating the names of people for the record.
Right.
So
without legislation, wouldn't the board generally, if the board wanted to under state law, what is the discretion of a board to set the majority? And
Monroe, I think it depends on the kind of
resolution. The issues involved here.
It depends on the issues involved. In other words, let me do you straight corporate law, and you can draw your analogies perhaps even better than I can. In straight corporate law, as it exists today, when you have a significant event, and we talked about the definitions yesterday, a little, of what might be significant events, mergers, dissolutions, sale of all or substantially all of the assets, these type of major corporate events that alter in a significant fashion what's going on in that corporation. When you get those kinds of significant corporate events, state law has said 2/3. When the AFN and the Native community have gone to Congress for similar types of significant events, they've gone for a majority of the outstanding shares. Okay? So when the Native community went before to Congress for the merger issue, which is a significant corporate event that alters the rules of the game and alters significantly what's going on, as opposed to voting on who's going to be elected director or this type of thing, the standard that was passed at the congressional level for that significant event was a majority of the outstanding shares, which is similar to what Charlie was referring to, 50% plus one.
Where would you put, just to jump ahead for a moment, removal of restrictions on the sale of stock? Under state law, if there were a state law equivalent?
Since right now the law is that in 1991 there will be no restrictions on stock, I would say that for a corporation to apply those restrictions, I would say that's an extremely significant corporate event, and I would argue for a majority of the outstanding shares. But I want to tell you, who cares what I would argue? What I really want to point out to you is the danger of the board having the power because of the potential for abuse of the board setting different standards based on what the board wants, having nothing to do with what the shareholders want. If that's really what I'm trying to address.
I'd like to respond to that briefly.
Yeah, Charlie Johnson.
You know, you're making some assumptions that the board is generally not acting in the best interest of the stockholders, I don't think that's a very accurate assumption. You're assuming that the board is going to use the powers that it already has to perpetuate perpetuate itself or to perhaps not act in the best interest of the stockholders. Now, going back to the history of ANCSA corporations and why only a majority of the stockholders rather than two-thirds as is required in normal corporations, and the reason for that is you take a normal corporation, there's always some concentration of stock and major blocks of stock that makes it much easier to get the type of participation that's required in major events. With native corporations, when we all almost have, at least we started out with all having the same amount of stock, it becomes a popular vote rather than a vote of the concentration of shares. And even in a normal corporation, like I think we're all involved in corporations other than ANCSA corporations, I know, for instance, on one corporation I'm involved in where less than about 10% of the shareholders can in fact vote the two-thirds majority that is required because of the concentration of stock. But I seem to have problems. I have problems with your assumption that the boards will utilize the powers they already have, you know, not in the best interest of the stockholders.
Elizabeth, and then Dan Fessler.
Charlie, I'm not assuming that the board will or will not do a certain thing. What I am is a lawyer. And as a lawyer, I try never to give groups more power than is needed to accomplish a task. And I certainly always try to pay attention to any powers that are uncurbed. And I represent management, so I suppose it's somewhat ironic for me to be arguing that this kind of power should not be given to the board of directors. I'm just suggesting to you that in general corporate law, this is not a power that's given to a board of directors, and I consider it a danger, not because I consider native boards in general unresponsive to their shareholders, but because I'm a lawyer and I know what unfettered power is and does, and I think it's a mistake, and that's just because of my background, and lawyers tend to be suspicious creatures, and that's just, you should accept that as part of my background.
Dan Fessler, you wanted to add something?
Well, I'll begin by confessing that I'm also a lawyer. I'm also a school teacher, and so maybe I'm at odds with internally. I think that it might help if we put this discussion in a more general concept. As I understand it, and in any assumption that I articulate that's wrong, please no one hesitate to correct me, the idea to have the fruits of the native settlement devolve upon corporations was something which was pretty well thrust upon the native population. The corporation has not been used in this manner, to my knowledge.
I think that first assumption is subject to question.
Okay.
Let him carry it through.
The corporation used in the manner of suddenly saying these will be the corporate assets and this group of individuals will be the shareholders, and the shares will be distributed to these individuals by virtue of their being identified as the natives in the state of Alaska is a fairly unique phenomenon. The idea of Congress was that the corporations were to be created under Alaska's corporation law. Alaska's corporation law in 1971, as it is today, was essentially taken by the first Alaska legislature from the corporation law as it then existed in the state of Oregon. In other words, on the day that Alaska became a state, it suddenly had to pass laws on all manner of matters that had heretofore been regulated by Congress acting. And so what they decided to do was to look to the law of the state of Oregon. Now, that's where we got our existing corporation law from. Under the existing corporation law, the control and management of a corporation is legally envisioned as being lodged with the board of directors. Right? Shareholders are envisioned as having an essentially passive role. Their one major prerogative under the corporation's code of the state of Alaska is to elect directors. Beyond that, the only time the board of directors has to go to the shareholders under existing law for the purpose of ascertaining whether they consent is if there's a desire to amend the content of the articles of incorporation. That cannot be done by the board alone. If there is a desire to take the corporation through what is generically called an organic change, which is what Liz was indicating when we're talking about mergers, consolidations, stock, sale of all the stock, transfer of all the assets other than the ordinary course. There, the law protects the shareholders, recognizing that after one of those transactions, you're going to be the shareholder in a fundamentally altered institution. Right? Now, those are the essential features of the law, and so whether or not you have, and I can't tell when we talk here, Charlie, about decisions. In other words, if there are options that devolve upon the corporation, the issue put in its most easily understood fashion, which is the only way I understand these, is whether or not it is akin to one of those organic changes, in which case shareholders could say we have a statutory right to be consulted, or whether or not it would amount to essentially altering the content of the articles of incorporation of a given corporation, in which case the shareholders could say we have a legal right to participate in that decision. The board isn't competent to do it alone. But failing that, the status quo is that the board has the power, and if the shareholders don't like the decision, then in theory one elects new people to the board, hopefully people who will be able to reverse the decisions that the shareholders find distasteful. But there is a way within all of your corporations at the present time without going beyond your corporation. In other words, without having to even go to the AFN, let alone to the Alaska legislature, and certainly not to the Congress of the United States, and ask them to do you a big favor in which you can protect yourself. I don't know what types of articles of incorporation are common in the regional corporations, nor what types of articles of incorporation are found in many of the village corporations, but it would be possible for you to use the articles of incorporation to define areas of great interest to the shareholders wherein you want to arrive at a status quo position and you wish to make it difficult to change that decision by simply enshrining whatever position you want to have in the articles of incorporation. And one of the things you can do in the articles of incorporation is raise the percentage necessary to vote on changing the articles of incorporation. And you have the power right now under the law to do those things to protect yourselves. You don't need
with that power reside, the board or the shareholders.
Right now, in order to do this, you'd have to change the articles. This will require, therefore, the cooperation of the incumbent board and the shareholders. Neither institution, the board nor the shareholders, has the power to amend the articles. Right? Together, they do. And having amended the articles, you can set the terms under which in the future those articles can be changed beyond those amendments. And you can be very discriminatory. You do not have to lock your corporation up with 90% voting requirements for all changes to the articles. You can bullet particular provisions of the articles and say, as to these will we require 90% voting requirements. In other words, the state law, which is the basic law we must look to for the conduct of the corporations, even today, and more so after 1991, the state law in Alaska is very permissive. It permits you to do a great deal under the articles, and the pending legislation in the Alaska legislature come January, which the AFN endorsed in the last legislature, is also very permissive in permitting you to tailor articles that are the way you want them for your corporation. Politically, at this moment, it would require that you get your incumbent board and your shareholders into sharing the view as to what you want done.
What percentage of shareholder assent do you need to change the articles?
50%.
Of the shareholders, not of a quorum, 50% of the shareholders.
Oh, that, I again, we'd have to look at what your articles say,
no,
because
I'm
you can raise or lower
law,
that. But
law.
Under current state law, it's 50%. It may be two-thirds. I'm being told it's two-thirds. The traditional Model Act rule was that it was 50%.
Of all shareholders.
Of all shareholders. In other words, it would be an absolute majority of the shares. But remember that those votes can be cast by proxy as well as in person.
Right. Well, the point that Elizabeth made was slightly different, and that was, as I understand it, that if the board of a particular corporation was eager to see one of these proposals under consideration at the AFN convention passed by the shareholders, they would set a very low standard of passage.
And if they were eager to see one defeated by the shareholders, they could set it at 90% and be reasonably certain it wouldn't be passed. That was the suggestion Elizabeth made.
It would be highly unusual for a board of directors in an area where there was not much question but that it was committed to the board's decision by state law. In other words, the shareholders' opinion would be purely advisory. The board could decide, even though it might not in the eyes of the state be legally bound by that decision, to submit any decision to a vote of the shareholders. And if we're talking about that kind of a vote, it is absolutely true that the board could set the terms under which the shareholders' decision would be taken. But the point I want you to understand is that in the absence of the areas that I articulated, the amendment of the articles, the decision to take the corporation through an organic change, the vision of a corporation, and it has always helped me since the third grade to draw pictures, is of a pyramid. The shareholders are at the bottom and they are numerous. Their function is that they are the equitable owners of the corporate assets after all obligations to third parties are satisfied. Their prerogative is to select a representative group called the board of directors. The directors have as their major task charting in a broad outline the policies of the corporation and engaging the corporate officers. The corporate officers act for the corporation as its agents to transact business with the world at large, to deal with third persons. A corporation, as was pointed out in Mr. Bass's rather interesting paper, which I read on the way up, is in point of fact a rather strange creature of our imagination. It is a legal fiction, but if the corporation is tried to be given human attributes, the shareholders are hard to put in the matter. But the board is the brain, and the legs and the mouth and the arms that deal and make signs to the outside world are supposed to be the officers. Directors, as such, have no power to bind the corporation individually. They operate only as a collective body. It's the officers who are the agents of the corporation.
Well, your point, I believe, is that the instead of going to Congress and asking them to set these standards of passage, the corporations could actually amend their articles and provide for certain standards of passage depending on the particular organic act under consideration.
And another thing that you can do, or I would suggest we think about doing, one other way to begin, I notice here that one of the whereas provisions or reasons for Resolution 84-01 is the idea that each of these corporations should take the decision with some sensitivity as to the way in which other corporations are evolving a position on those decisions, because after all, we're all in this thing together and we don't want to be pulling oars in opposite directions. Well, there are ways in which you can use simple contracts to work out treaties as between the corporations without having to go through any specter of setting up a larger corporate entity above them or otherwise. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can do with this structure, whether I am ill-informed that it was sort of dropped upon you as an idea or whether it's the one you reached in the great grab bag of life and pulled out and said, this is what we want, the corporate form. You've got it now, and it has lots of opportunities and lots of pressure points that are under your dominion as opposed to requiring anybody to come along and deal the cards out to you a different way.
Can I suggest that we go to the first one? Because I'd like to, it might be interesting to look at these shareholder questions in the light of particular decisions. It's also possible that this resolution mandates corporations to do things that they might not do. That is to say, the minimum, for example, which decisions have to be made by shareholders, and the minimum level necessary, which is different from Liz's point. That is to say, does this act force certain decisions to go to shareholders that wouldn't otherwise go to shareholders? And does it force a level below which the corporation could go under existing state law, above which? Yeah, but you can't tell by looking at 8401 without looking at the context of each of the resolutions.
I'd like to ask one other question. You mentioned
Charlie Johnson
earlier, a couple paragraphs ago, that directors presently have the power
for setting standards of shareholder acceptance of specific actions. And
only in the sense, Charlie, that if a decision is one which legally the directors could make on their own,
okay,
it is within the power of the board to decide that they would take an advisory vote or poll of the shareholders in order to assist them in making that decision. They would not normally be thought to be legally bound by such a thing, which is why I called it an advisory vote. Indeed, if you go to areas that may have little relevance to our discussion, normally directors are not supposed to do that. In other words, you're not supposed to elect a director and then have the director constantly be coming back to you and asking, what am I to do, what am I to do, what am I to do? If you think of the pyramid, the whole purpose of having the board was to elect a smaller group that could make decisions and be cohesive, as opposed to having to go to the much larger group and constantly ask for a polling of the situation. Corporations were not Athenian democracies. I mean, only you elected a representative body. So in that sense, the board could go to the shareholders and say, unless three-fourths of you say no, we're proposing to do this. Or they could say, unless 90% of you say no, we're proposing to do this. Those are advisory votes. There are very few areas under which the board would be legally obligated to go to the shareholders.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Could I just, Claude Dementiev and then David Case wanted to get into this. Claude, you go ahead.
As I understand the state law, there's two different votes. There's for the basic changes in the bylaws or the articles of incorporation, more so the bylaws, I believe, it's 50% of a quorum. For extraordinary changes in the corporation, it requires two-thirds, such as liquidation of assets, etc. This resolution here, I'm assuming a lot of things. I'm asking more question if my assumption is right, that this resolution here allows the board of directors to set the vote circumventing state law on the minimum number of votes required without even changing their own bylaws. They could set the vote by resolution of a board.
One thing I don't understand, Claude, so I can't really respond until you clarify it on it. If this has been passed, I understand, by the AFN. Is that correct?
Well, it hasn't been, according to Charlie.
No, here's a process that we're going through, and hopefully we'll go through a similar process like this and come up with objections like Liz is making before we go ahead and pass these. What we passed at the last convention was that we accepted a process that mandated that management and the leadership of AFN get out to the regions and the villages and go over these resolutions, hopefully making them understood. And out of that will come what will be acceptable to everybody in going to Congress for amendments on ANCSA 1991. And it may very well be that the very point that Liz is raising may be one of the objections, and that may very well not pass AFN. It will be presented to AFN in a different matter that would take care of the objections that might arise, such as the one that Liz is talking about.
Let me just say that it also may be that, just before we go on, Claude asked a question characterizing this and not seeking to be pejorative, and Dan didn't answer, but Elizabeth, you were nodding in affirmation. Did you agree with Claude's characterization?
Claude, can I repeat it back to make sure I've got it? But as I understood what you were asking, if the